The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
We are at the will a little bit of current events, right? So even though we can sit up here all day long and talk about how we have to pass the Intelligence Authorization Act and 702, which 702 has to get done, But if something horrible were to happen tomorrow, that means a third priority, right? So we have to adjust our schedule. And like Michael was saying, with 702, we have the foresight to say, okay, let's get this ball rolling. Let's try to keep ahead of the curve, right? I do think that it is worth mentioning, however, that at any point in time, the executive branch could come down and say, we want this as a priority, right? So it's also for us trying to understand, what is the executive branch doing? What are their priorities over the next few years? We have to get kind of guiding posts from them as well. So, you know, who knows what might happen tomorrow where the executive branch come out and say, hey, we want you guys to pursue X, or we want to do Y.
I'm Quinta Jurassic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 18th, 2017. Trump has promised to end the defense sequester and make the development of defensive and offensive cyber capabilities a White House priority. But the contours of U.S. cyber policy under the new administration have yet to be set. So what should we expect? To answer that question, we're bringing you audio of a conference hosted by Lawfare in partnership with the Hoover Institution in Washington and Intel Security. Featuring the keynote address by Steve Grobman, Chief Technology Officer of Intel Security, and a panel on What Can We Expect from Congress, moderated by Carrie Johnson of National Public Radio, and featuring Hill staffers including Brett DeWitt, Hope Goins, Alan Souza, Michael Bahar, and Brett Friedman. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 213, Cybersecurity in the Trump Administration.
I want to begin by talking a little bit about how Intel Security, soon to become McAfee, sees cybersecurity threat landscape changing, evolving, growing. The industry must evolve. And what we want to offer in today's discussion is some very specific recommendations to the new Trump administration. You know, when we think about the challenges that we face, it's more significant than any single company is able to address on its own. The real challenge of cybersecurity is going to require leadership from Washington, from public-private partnerships, and from the industry as a whole. And part of the issue is that the threat landscape is inherently ever-changing and complex. If you think about internet-enabled devices, where there will soon be hundreds of millions smart connected devices, or new compute paradigms, things that we've seen in the past few years, like cloud computing, these introduce new challenges to the security defenders in our industry. Yet, ultimately, the job of the security practitioner hasn't changed. At the end of the day, it's about protecting vital services and data from theft, manipulation, or loss due to external or internal adversaries. So while our mission hasn't changed, we do need to think about how the changes that are going on within the world that we live changes our job. We need to understand current, but also the forward-looking emerging threats. We need to learn how to think like the adversary. We need to be willing to embrace new models in order to defend these environments. We need to think about better ways to automate or use concepts like what we call human-machine teaming, where you actually get the cybersecurity operators working seamlessly in conjunction with the technology. We need to be realistic and recognize that the attack surface continues to grow. And this means that not only organizations, but individuals are more vulnerable than ever and in more places. You know, adversaries are increasingly capable of attacking strategic assets and critical infrastructure. Traditional platforms that we're very familiar with, whether they're phones, tablets, laptops, servers, continue to be high-value targets. But we also must expand our thinking to include all devices that are smart and connected. You know, modern computing, it runs our factories, it flies our planes, it drives our cars, and now it runs our homes. Almost every aspect of what our country runs on is potentially vulnerable to attack. We also need to think about the evolving motivation for cyber attacks, whether it's encrypting data, not to steal it, but to hold it for ransom, or to compromise a consumer electronic device for the purpose of converting it into part of the weaponry that a bad actor is to use. This last example, it's not science fiction. It's exactly what happened in October of 2016, where we saw the Mirai botnet. This was where compromised consumer-grade IoT devices, things like DVRs and home routers and cameras, were compromised and turned into attacking devices to go after Dyn, a internet provider that ultimately caused Twitter, Spotify, other major technical properties on the internet to be impacted. And the reason this is important is it really shows the leading edge of what's to come. If we think about other elements in our daily life, the future of autonomous transportation is in its infancy, but it relies on us getting the cybersecurity technology right now, so that we're not standing here a decade later saying, why didn't we do a better job architecting the right capabilities into autonomous vehicles? So the net is, you no longer need to sit at a computer or hold a smartphone in order to be a target of a cyber attack. We must not ignore the critical systems that run our companies, organizations, and government, and yet most organizations still lack the resources necessary to adequately monitor their networks or defend against sophisticated attacks. To overcome this overwhelming, ever-changing threat landscape, we must work together as a coalition. So we call this at McAfee, Together is Power. This will be the tenet to drive a force behind our new McAfee brand that's currently planned to be a standalone company in just a few months. It's all about getting different elements to work together. It's about having technologies to work together by using things that we call open fabrics to be able to communicate. It's about enabling all of us in the cybersecurity industry to work together in ways that we've never thought as being feasible. And to be successful, we must understand the market-like forces that drive the effectiveness of cyber defense. What's fascinating about this is most IT technologies are very different from cybersecurity technologies. If you think about IT technologies, they get better over time. So if you think about networking or database systems or most applications, there's a constant state of evolution. Whereas what we see in cybersecurity technologies is a very interesting phenomenon where cybersecurity technologies are most effective during their initial inception. And the reason for this is they're built by looking at what the current problem statement is within the industry. But then as soon as the industry adopts new defensive capabilities and deploys them, bad actors create new countermeasures, evasion tactics, and ultimately the efficacy of these technologies declines. So the question this really leaves us with is where does it leave us? So if we see the current paradigm of constant integration of point products as being ineffective and unsustainable, what are we going to do when we not only see that the technology efficacy is declining in individual products, but also recognize the reality that most complex organizations require 30 or 40 independent tools and technology to protect their environments. It's a losing game if we play by the existing rules. We need a fundamentally different approach. And this is where technology can be thought of a little bit differently. It needs to be thought of being rapidly developed, but then integrated into security platforms. Platforms that can communicate over open communication protocols and work with operators that are able to work in this human-machine teaming concept where they take the things that are very unique to human beings, that strategic intellect, and marry that with what technology is very good at. Big data analytics, being able to work with information very rapidly that is collected from many different points throughout an organization. The key to having a winning cybersecurity strategy is to bring the technology, the cybersecurity industry, and the efforts ultimately between government and the private sector together. And when we say together is power, as our forward-looking statement of our mission and strategy, that's really what it's all about. So we need to look at what is working from a cybersecurity policy perspective. As we collaborate with our public partners, it is important that we highlight some of the things that have worked well and also recognize how cybersecurity has changed over the years. It is a top-tier issue for government leaders, really because of the recognized role that it plays in IT systems that are paramount to national security, our economy, and the daily lives of citizens of the United States. A few bipartisan examples where we have had successes. First, the NIST framework. It lays out a clear roadmap for organizations to evaluate and then enhance their cybersecurity readiness. Second, CISA, the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act of 2015, where it improved the ability for public and private sectors to share threat intelligence while creating safeguards for individual, personal, and private information. The information and analysis organizations and working groups, really to be able to facilitate the key chain exchange of threat intelligence information. These efforts mirror something that we're doing in the private sector, a new organization that was launched a few years ago called the Cyber Threat Alliance, where a handful of competitors within the cybersecurity industry have come together in order to share information amongst us in order to make the industry more secure and to allow all of us to do a better job in securing our customers. And fourth, the National Defense Authorization Act. So the most recent NDAA urges DoD to take an integrated approach in a wide range of security programs. It also shows the foresight and awareness in links between physical and digital world. That's very important if you think about some of the things that we talked about looking forward, not only related to critical infrastructure, but many of the evolving capabilities that will be in the lives of individual citizens. It also looks at other physical implementations, such as industrial control systems, that are key to our critical infrastructure protection. And finally, CDM, the Continuous Diagnostics and Mitigation Program, that DHS initiative, really moving civilian government agencies and others from a compliance-based model to risk-based cybersecurity. So these and other cybersecurity initiatives helped create the initial building blocks that we can build from. So it's a great start, but we now need to look forward into what we would like the new administration to do. So our new administration must provide cybersecurity defense as a key area of focus. When President Trump was on the campaign trail, he said that cybersecurity is the fastest growing crime in the United States. He committed to making cybersecurity top tier policy and operational priorities for his new administration. And he pledged to improve the United States' offensive and defensive cybersecurity capabilities. The new administration is already off to a good start. The draft executive order begins to operationalize candidate Trump's cybersecurity commitments. Our initial impressions are positive. Securing federal network systems. For too long, cybersecurity policies and operational outcomes have been delegated far down the management chain in government agencies, often with poor results. Holding heads of government agencies responsible for cybersecurity outcomes in their agencies and putting OMB with its budget authority in a leadership position to drive accountability throughout government has potential to radically improve the security posture of government agencies. Directing government agencies to adopt the NIST framework is a sensible policy. The framework was developed in collaborative manner between government and private sector, and it's been a useful de facto standard. Modernizing federal IT, the order directs agency leaders to plan and execute a deliberate modernization of federal executive branch IT. This is critically needed. As legacy systems lack the ability of modern security architectures to inherently be secure, you can only take a legacy system and patch it, wrap it, isolate it to such an extent, you ultimately are unable to create the same level of cybersecurity defense that you could with a new modern system. And the reason for this is the new modern development tools, development methodologies, and building blocks provide an inherently more secure level of capability than you're able to achieve than taking a legacy system and trying to adapt it. A good analogy is if you think about other elements of our physical infrastructure. I live in California, and as some of you may know, the Oakland Bay Bridge has recently gone under some major renovations. And if you look at the bridge, it had two sides to it. It had a side that they were able to retrofit in order to be adequate to withstand earthquakes that are potentially going to hit the region. But the other side of the bridge, there was no way to adapt the existing technology. And it actually required a new development methodology, a new construction of a new bridge. And that is a good way to think about what we must do with federal systems. There will be some areas that we can continue to shore up and patch to get us by. But in some cases, we will need to go to modern construction techniques, in this case, of the cybersecurity variety, in order to really be ready for the security challenges of 2017 and beyond. So if properly managed and funded, this draft order would enable the retirement, replacement, and modernization of legacy IT that is difficult to secure and expensive to maintain. These actions are critical, long overdue, steps that will help secure and make government IT systems more efficient and cost-effective to run. But not modernizing will ultimately lead to larger costs. To deal with breaches reactively. So the important point here is there is a clear ROI in rebuilding and modernizing our federal systems, but we also must recognize the cost of not doing it, not only in cost of running the legacy systems, but in the cost of dealing with the breaches that are sure to occur. The OPM hack is a perfect example. It had immense economic and non-economic consequences. The economic costs alone are enormous. Rebuilding OPM, state and defense IT infrastructure, $650 million. Notifying and protecting identities for federal employees, $133 million to $500 million. But it's the non-economic costs, the threat that adversaries can cross-check personal data on our most sensitive government employees that imposes the most significant long-term cost to our country. So this one incident having over $1 billion of financial impact and immeasurable cost in the impact to our national security is just one example of what will be more to come if we don't move forward with modernizing our IT systems. We need to secure our critical infrastructure. The draft order directs the Secretary of Homeland Security and agency heads to identify federal authorities and capabilities needed to come up with a plan to help critical infrastructure companies secure themselves. So if properly managed and executed in a voluntary manner with the private sector to protect the most critical of critical infrastructure, such as core communication, infrastructure, and power grid, much good could come from this directive. The draft executive order uses the same definition of critical infrastructure, Section 9 companies, used by the Obama administration that excluded information technology companies from enhanced regulatory exposure. Continuing this policy makes sense to ensure that America's IT companies can continue to innovate in a quickly changing global market. Once we have seen the final order, we'll be able to we'll be in a position to give it a lengthy review and finalize our position on it. Finally, the administration has moved quickly to make some strong personal appointments. Tom Bossert as Homeland Security Advisor, Joshua Steinman to lead the National Security Council cybersecurity effort, and Rudy Giuliani to chair the White House Cybersecurity Task Force. Congress has also acted to confirm new leaders of our Defense Homeland Security and Intelligence Departments with impressive cybersecurity credentials. We expect to work closely with these people and others to offer the best perspective they need so they can make the best decisions. While, as we've seen, the security landscape is constantly changing, we believe there are some high-level recommendations we can make right now. First, as the Trump administration reviews its options for supporting the multi-stakeholder process to ensure the internet remains valuable, reliable, and secure, we urge the administration to focus on establishing international norms and standards in cyberspace. From hacktivists to cyber criminals, the threat landscape is global, and our policy must respond in such a manner. Where we have good tools in the U.S., such as the NIST framework, we should work to disseminate them globally. Other nations have already taken an interest in this common sense tool that focuses on risk management rather than static compliance and embodies the public-private partnership necessary to help transform cybersecurity on a global scale. Second, the Trump administration must establish a secure e-government, as it is said it will do. There is no reason citizens should stand in long lines at government service offices or wait on phones in the age of e-government. So far, however, major hacks have not inspired confidence in the security of civilian government systems and data. Citizens need to trust the digital interactions with government to fully realize the promise of e-government, which can also reduce operating costs and create efficiencies for government agencies. Government systems need to have comprehensive end-to-end cybersecurity, and citizens need the provided tools such as digital certificates, secure IDs, and encryption to enable more secure interactions with government. Third, the administration will need to solidify its information sharing strategy. Sharing of threat intelligence information has been a necessity since I started in cybersecurity, yet we still haven't locked down the standards and processes for doing so in a meaningful way. DHS and its working groups have created a path to get there, but we're not far enough along the way. We need to recognize the reality around the challenges of threat intelligence. Threat intelligence suffers from what we call the free rider problem. This means that threat intelligence is something that everyone wants to consume, yet there's very little incentive to publish or give. And then due to its nature, if there's no incentive for individual organizations or bodies to contribute to a threat intelligence pool, there's nothing in the pool to receive. So overcoming this inherent market-driven condition is something that we will need to work through a strong partnership in order to make sure that there is value in providing information in order to drive the aggregate good. The Trump administration should double down with the private sector to further evolve the way cyber threat information is represented and transported. Cyber criminals, they're excellent at information sharing. The government and private sector ought to be too. Fourth, the administration must maintain a voluntary engagement on securing critical infrastructure. Historically, cyber threats remained in the digital world. Data was stolen or held for ransom. Networks are breached or brought down. Systems were infected by malware. These exploits were bad enough, but now we see cyber attacks are moving into the physical realm. As the Internet of Things has exponentially expanded opportunities for hackers to infiltrate more than just the digital world, we've seen attacks on dams and other critical infrastructures. As I've mentioned, it's not just about attacking devices to inflict damage on the device itself, but also to convert the device into an asset for the attacker. The federal government has a legitimate interest in making sure critical infrastructure is secure, but the private sector must continue to lead without regulatory mandates, lest regulatory substitutes compliance for real security. As a new administration works on fundamental tax reform, it should consider granting critical infrastructure companies tax benefits, possibly refundable tax credits, to incentivize them to shore up their cyber defenses. Positive incentives rather than punitive regulations will help produce real results. The other challenge that we see related to regulation is the opportunity cost of being compliant with a regulation will often detract from the ability to concentrate on the most significant risks of the day. By focusing on the highest profile risks, will ultimately enable the private sector to provide the most secure foundation for the critical infrastructure and other key capabilities. Fifth, and probably the most important recommendation for the Trump administration, is investment in cybersecurity as a foundational piece of his larger infrastructure build-out. We urge the new administration to double down on its commitments in this area. Investments start with cyber education and training. One piece of the cyber debt that's been ignored is developing the next generation of cybersecurity experts. A report we conducted with the Center for Strategic and International Studies found that a majority of IT professionals around the world think their government is not investing enough in building cybersecurity talent, and that the skill shortage results in measurable damage. We recommend an even larger financial investment in existing federal workforce and education programs to showcase a diversity of career paths for interested students, and then coordinating these initiatives with the private sector. For instance, the Cyber Corps Scholarship for Services Program. It trains students and places them in government jobs for just a few years, equipping them to pursue a cybersecurity career wherever they want. The program is ideal for students looking to pay back their scholarships upfront with 2 or 3 years in federal service. But for students interested in serving their government while jumpstarting a career in the private sector, creating alternate paths to scholarship repayment could also bring more talent to bear. To that end, we recommend the government consider the creation of a Cyber National Guard program. At the state and federal level, an expanded SFS or SFS-style grant program could train and educate a new class of cyber practitioners prepared to serve government on a full-time, part-time, or as-needed basis while gaining critical experience with the latest private sector innovators. We in the private sector must also be prepared to level up our collaboration with government to ensure a steady supply of worthwhile internships, co-ops, and training opportunities. In the CSIS report, a lack of quality training opportunities was cited as a significant reason why cyber practitioners seek alternative employment. So we must work together to make sure the best talent is not exclusive to our industry, but we're willing to open to support the government in promoting cybersecurity. Investing in education and training is one thing, but we also must invest in paying down the cyber debt in other ways. As IT innovation has accelerated and technology has assumed a dominant place in our lives and economy, we have invested too little in cybersecurity, particularly in the IT and industrial control systems that protect the most critical infrastructure the federal government has. With each passing day, agencies have become further exposed to more cyber breaches. Because of the cyber debt, the ever-widening gap between investments necessary to secure our growing digital world and the resources actually deployed to do so, we're playing catch-up. And we still have years of cyber debt to pay down. The Office of Management and Budget says nearly 80% of federal IT spending planned for the next fiscal year targets legacy systems. 78%, or about $63 billion of the $82 billion for fiscal year 2017 IT budgets. Most of this spending is for maintaining and upgrading current IT infrastructure. Far too many of these federal IT systems are vulnerable to cybersecurity risks because they were not designed to make use of modern security best practices. And development methodologies and other ways that modern architectures and systems are built are key in retooling these underlying systems, which in some cases will require entire replacement cycles. And that is why we are so pleased that the administration is making this a top priority. The administration should work with Congress to fund the significant IT modernization plan he has announced. At the same time, the administration should help states address their own cybersecurity vulnerabilities. DHS and other programs are going to be key to facilitating bringing these defenses forward and online. And finally, encryption policy is of particular importance to us. Intel Security respects and is grateful for the tireless work of the public servants who further law enforcement and protect national security. As a technology company, we are committed to assisting both government and law enforcement in the battle against cybercrime. We and other technology companies have a long history of responding to lawful demands for information from government agencies. However, we remain aligned with most technology companies and leaders around privacy and other key elements that also impact this very challenging issue. The privacy community is working with issues that they believe there are big challenges in creating backdoors or other key escrow-based solutions into products. And we must recognize that in order to really look at encryption policy, we need to test whether we're solving the problem with the solution that is being recommended or stated. So the problem statement that we all agree on is we desire law enforcement to be able to get access to information that is being held by terrorists or other criminal actors. Encryption makes that hard. But the question that I ask is, does creating mandates on devices that would create backdoors or require other key escrowing capabilities actually solve that problem? I would argue no. I would argue that based on the nature of encryption, where it's ultimately just math, and bad actors that are motivated to securely encrypt data that is not accessible by law enforcement can do so by downloading readily available open source or readily available applications globally and encrypt that data in such a way that regardless of what is done on a device level, law enforcement would not be able to access the underlying data. So I would ask, have we done anything other than damage the privacy challenges of the non-criminal and bad actor community? The U.S. government attempts to mandate technology feature decreases Americans' companies to resist attempts by other governments to regulate products as well. We need to recognize that the United States leads by examples, and what comes down as a mandate in this country can be repurposed by other countries to ultimately place devices and the citizens of the United States at greater risk as opposed to reduced risk. We know the Trump administration is committed to strengthening our national cybersecurity capabilities. We at McAfee and the rest of the industry, we're all fighting for the same thing, to defeat the cyber enemy. Whether they're hacktivists, cyber criminals, or nation states, we can't do it alone. We need continued technology innovation, a tightly integrated fabric to make these innovations actually useful across the security industry and the public-private partnerships that we have begun to move us forward. What that's really all about is this concept of together is power. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions that anybody has.
You talked about making the heads of the agencies personally accountable, but I find it hard to believe that these head of agencies are going to have any experience in cybersecurity to be able to do a good job.
So the way that I would equate it is I don't see it being any different than a CEO in the private sector. If you're a CEO of a pharmaceutical company, you likely don't have any expertise in the mechanics of cybersecurity either, but yet you're able to accept the risk that cybersecurity imposes on your organization, and you're able to learn about the most critical elements of cybersecurity in order to ensure that risk has been mitigated to the extent that you're comfortable for your shareholders and board. I think that is a reasonable level for us to hold agency heads to as well.
You mentioned in the executive order use of Section 9, critical infrastructure companies, but doesn't it also sort of create this new, the draft that Paul Rosenzweig posted, to create this new category of core communications infrastructure that it seems to be a completely new concept. It might include your parent entity. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure. I think there are two things that I would say. Number one, a lot of the infrastructure that we have in place from the original internet was never built to withstand the cyber attacks that we see today. I think the Dyn attack in October is a great example of that. The domain name system that translates domain names into IP addresses never comprehended distributed denial of service attacks, and ultimately that made it a lot easier for the adversaries. I caution, though, against getting too aggressive to move to a clean slate without always ensuring that pragmatism trumps all, no pun intended. And the example I'll give is look at IP version 6. That was intended to overcome some of the deficiencies that we had with IPv4. It's 20 years later, and we still don't have IPv6 deployed. So we do need to look at retooling some of the key communication capabilities, but at the same time, we need to do so with an eye towards pragmatism.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Hope Goins. I'm the staff director for the Department of Homeland Security, the Democratic staff. This year is going to be a banner year for cybersecurity as we embark on a new administration. I'll let my colleague, Brett, who worked on some bills that we had during the Obama administration, discuss those bills. But those bills became law. And as we look at the Trump administration and what the Trump administration plans to do, with the cybersecurity executive order that will be coming out in the next few days. We want the authorities that have been given to the Department of Homeland Security to stay intact. DHS's execution of the Cybersecurity Act of 2015 has not been perfect, but it's on the right track. And with proper oversight, we can try to get it to stay working and to move in a proper direction. On top of that, we still have lingering there was interference into our 2016 presidential elections. We do know that there has been evidence that Russia interfered into our 2016 elections, and the Democrats on Capitol Hill, led by Congressman Swalwell and Congressman Cummings, along with a Republican co-sponsor Walter Jones, are leading an effort to establish an independent commission to actually look into what happened in the 2016 elections and to try to make sure that it doesn't happen again, not necessarily in 2018, but also throughout, to see if it, to make sure that it does not trickle down to the states. And they're still looking for more Republican support on this. That's the drumbeat that is going out from the Democrats, that we need an independent commission, an independent bipartisan commission. Select subcommittees and getting this and committee investigations, they're okay, but they would still be pretty partisan. And we think that this, that something this serious would need independence.
Hi, my name is Michael Bahar. I'm the HPSI, so the House Intelligence Committee's minority, meaning Democratic staff director and general counsel. And I'd agree with Hope that this is going to be a banner year for cyber in Congress. And that's not a good thing. If it's a banner year for cyber, that means a lot's going wrong. And we've kicked off the year with a lot going wrong with the with Russia and its hacking into an influence campaign, because it's broader than just the hacking, into the 2016 election. So that's obviously something our committee is starting the year off looking at in depth, and we are doing a bipartisan inquiry into the events and circumstances surrounding that active measures campaign that included cyber activity. But in many ways, clearly that's not going to be the only thing that we're looking at in cyber. And the way I think about it, certainly for far too many industries, is that we're in a pre-Enron phase. You think about Enron, right? What led to that were board members and senior executives at companies saying, it looks fine, if there's an accounting issue, call the accountants. And I think that's where we are still in many industries for cyber. It's a cyber issue, call the IT folks. And what that means is, I think, you know, we've heard panels on what's next in the administration, what's next in Congress, we're starting that in. But I think a lot of it's also going to be driven at what's the court, what are the courts going to do, and how do Congress respond to that? Right, what is a reasonable level of precaution you should take to protect either your intellectual property, which could include your shareholders' value, or the private data of your customers? What is the reasonable standard of care? That's probably going to start to be litigated in the courts. Now, as we heard in the first panel, certain states are starting to step in advance of those courts by setting certain minimum standards. New York is really taking the lead on it. I think it was just yesterday, the day before, Maria Vullo came out and said, these are it. And I think if you look through those, it's a really wise model. It's tech neutral. It's incentivizing. It's setting a floor, but encouraging companies to do more. And that's another reason why I say we're in the pre-Enron phase, is those companies, those private sector entities that are going to go left of boom, that are going to start to take the precautions, they're going to start to build up their cybersecurity expertise, they're going to start asking the right questions, are going to get out ahead of the courts and probably going to get out ahead of where Congress can influence as well. But the other thing I would say about the way Congress shapes the field of cyber, and all of us here have really worked together on this, is, right, so, you know, Congress can try to take a a proscriptive approach. They can say, thou shalt not do this. They can take a prescriptive approach that thou shalt do this. But what we found, for example, in the Cybersecurity Act of 2015, is what's really effective is to incentivize. How do we create the incentives, the atmosphere for better cybersecurity? So in the Cybersecurity Act of 2015, working with our Homeland colleagues, what we did, we said, okay, you get liability protection if you share cyber threat indicators, if you share malware. The idea being, hey, we're all going to be safer if we all know the pathogens out there. Let's stop hoarding them or start thinking that it's going to be an antitrust problem or it's going to be some other type of problem. Let's get it out there and then figure out how do we deal with it. Those are the kind of things I suspect you're going to see Congress looking at more. How do we incentivize things, either through the carrot approach, which was the Cybersecurity Act 2015, or New York took a little bit of the stick approach, said you must have this. We'll talk more about NIST standards in the future, but this is the way, at least from our perspective, we're thinking about these things.
Yeah, so I'm Alan Souza. I'm a HPSI majority, one of the HPSI majority councils, which I'm feeling outnumbered by the minority around me. It's unusual. in all seriousness, I echo Michael's thoughts. And for me, one of the things mentioned in the previous panel was that this year one of the major legislative pushes is going to be FISA Amendments Act reauthorization. So Section 702 is what we're going to be talking about a lot this year. And in the cyber context, when a cyber event or attack, however you want to define it, happens, it's important, especially against the government, it's important to understand who is behind the attack, right? So for us on the Intelligence Committee, it's making sure that the intelligence community has the tools they need to figure out the plans and intentions of bad actors abroad, right? Who is trying to hurt us from a foreign intelligence perspective? And so, some of the comments on the earlier panel ring true in terms of during the Section 702 debates this year, you're going to hear things probably like data privacy, data transference across boundaries. What is it, the privacy shield, PPD 28, those types of discussions. But in the end, it's important to recognize the value of things like 702 and that what it brings to national security.
Great. So Brett DeWitt, staff director of the Cyber Subcommittee for the House Homeland Security Committee, work for Chairman Michael McCaul. Looking at our action plan path ahead, our plan is to basically build on the cyber bills that we've enacted over the last two Congresses. Back in 2014, we've passed five foundational cybersecurity bills. They were very foundational. That really laid the groundwork to pass the big Cybersecurity Act of 2015, working with my colleagues here on the panel to get that done. And so path ahead for us is we got the authorities in place, clarifying roles and responsibilities for the interagency, kind of who does what. But what's missing now is kind of what underpins those authorities, which is the organizational structure and how do you streamline at DHS. It's currently in office, but how do you streamline their operation to become more operational? And so we'll be looking at kind of the meat and potatoes issues that are so critical to underpin to be successful at carrying out those authorities. But talking about acquisition, procurement, how do you build, a larger human capital pipeline for both the federal government, private sector, hiring authorities, bringing people in the mix, making it easier for cyber professionals to come in and out of the government more easily to do the national security mission focus. And so that will be a big focus. Our big legislative approach is through establishing a cybersecurity agency at the Department of Homeland Security. Its idea is to elevate the cyber mission, prioritize it on the leadership structure, again, streamline the bureaucratic issues that have basically tied its hands and feet from being fully operational. We need to eliminate those barriers. And so it's just really building on the authorities that we've given over these last couple of years. Some of the highlights that we'll be focusing on is Title II of the Cybersecurity Act is securing federal networks. DHS runs the two big cyber operation programs, the Einstein program and the Continuous Diagnostics and Mitigation program. We're doing a deep dive right now into how those programs working, what's broken, are they on the right track, how do we ensure that these large acquisition programs can continue to bring in new, innovative, cutting-edge technologies into the mix to secure federal networks. Looking government-wide across the entire federal enterprise, there needs to be coordination there. It's what the FISMA 14 law kind of dictated is OMB role is policy and DHS carry out the operations for securing .gov. So that will be a heavy focus for us. Kind of covered the workforce issues. We gave DHS expedited hiring authorities in 2014. Those authorities haven't been implemented yet, which is, in our opinion, is kind of holding back the tide from bringing and recruiting and retaining qualified cyber talent. And again, back into building capability capacity to carry out the civilian cyber defense mission for cybersecurity. We need that talent. Other areas that we're looking at is a cyber executive order that we all have been anticipating. We've seen drafts of, and we've been weighing in on that. You know, our biggest in message to the White House has been just the Congress has passed numerous cyber bills over the last several years that's ensured consistency with those laws, that's not contradict them or cause confusion of who does what and whose roles and you know, different roles and responsibilities. We want more clarity, less confusion. And that was what we've kind of messaged to the White House folks. Other big issues for us, cyber incident response. Presidential Policy Directive 41 came out over the summer that required finalization of the National Cybersecurity Incident Response Plan. That was released early January. So that's very fresh, very new. We're going to be looking at that, seeing, okay, when a major cyber incident takes place, you know, who does the private sector call? How is that coordinated across the interagency? You look at, we call it the bubble chart, but it's basically the initial lanes in the road set back in February 2013 that says, you know, FBI, cybercrime, DOD, NSA is foreign, overseas, DHS is protection of critical infrastructure. So looking at that and how the interagency process works is going to be key. Cyber insurance is going to be one for us. We're looking at market-driven approaches to address cyber risk management, kind of talking about the NIST cyber framework a bit. How can companies, private entities adopt that, and what can we do to kind of raise the bar for cybersecurity across critical infrastructure? 85% is owned by the private sector. These are voluntary relationships. So in order for them to be valuable, or to be adopted, they have to be valuable. And so we're going to be looking a lot at the metrics to score the value of these voluntary products, the voluntary information sharing scheme under the AIS program, Automated Indicator Sharing Program, that was established by the Cybersecurity Act. Metrics for ensuring actionable cyber threat information is being shared, quality assessments are being done, et cetera. So those are kind of the key highlights, top points.
Okay, thanks. Thank you to Lawfare and to Hoover for having us. Brett Friedman, I am the minority counsel for the Democratic side and the Senate Intelligence Committee. So I also feel outnumbered, at least from the bicameral side of things. But I hope you realize you're very fortunate here. You have two Bretts on a panel, both of whom have two T's in their first name, which is unusual as well. So that's a joy. There's a couple pieces. Looking at it from the Senate side of things, it's a bit of a different optic. I think part of that is kind of the jurisdictional quagmire amongst the committees themselves, right? You're speaking of cybersecurity, which in a discussion such as this is very centralized and easy, I get, to get your handle around what we're talking about. But at the same token, you talk about any issue in the federal government, crossing from the Postal Service to military to public infrastructure. It is every committee has an argument to make for them to have a play in this. So it's a much more difficult proposition to get something substantive and comprehensive through the Senate side of things. So I think looking at the guaranteed, if you will, although that's a tough word to use in this legislative world, but you have the Intelligence Authorization Act, the IAA, that's going to be put forward for FY18, and you have, as was mentioned previously, 702, which is expiring at the end of December. Despite one's perceptions one way or the other in regards to having sunsets on provisions for Congress, I think there's something to be said to say that, oh, we know we're going to have to deal with this by the end of this year, you know, and it may be December 30th or the 31st, Congress all of a sudden wakes up and says, oh God, this is expiring. But I do think we're taking a proactive approach from both sides and trying to look at it from the ground up, foundationally, what needs to transpire so that we're not in a predicament such as a last-minute type fire drill, for instance. I think just to dovetail off of what Michael was mentioning in regards to Enron, I think the part of the problem that I have in regards to not understanding, but dealing with cybersecurity, and I think this is more of a public perception, is quite frankly, you have individual private citizens who certainly understand as long as their phone works, as long as they're able to turn on the app, they're open their garage door, whatever it might be with the Internet of Things now penetrating other parts of one's life. Your identity gets stolen. It's a pain. It is something that you have to go and make several calls to various 800 numbers to make sure that everything's taken care of, and bank statements and Social Security, for instance. But at the baseline of that, what is the harm to you? Monetarily, no. The banks take care of that. The credit card companies for the fraudulent payments, they're on the hook for that. So I'm fearful, and the way why I'm saying this is because I'm fearful that there's, until such time as there is something that is that is quite tangible in the manifestation of what we mean with a cyber activity or cyber intrusion or a cyber event that is seen and visible and something that happens that the public is saying, oh, wait a sec, that is tied to, okay, I get it now, that you're going to have a difficulty from a baseline perspective politically to really get the generalized bipartisan, which you need, regardless of the political calculus now, as to get something through. And the only other piece I'd say on that, and hopefully this is generating some questions as well, is I think that our cyber security bill started things from an informational sharing perspective, but I think, and this is what I think the vice chairman would urge as well, Senator Warner, is more the moving that forward to a more a cooperative and a collaborative environment. It is one thing to have information sharing. It is another to have an open and active dialogue to really get an understanding of what is facing the private sector, how can government assist in that, and then working in parallel to get one to those ends. So I'll stop there.
You've set the table brilliantly. Thank you all very much. I'm going to dive in with some questions. First of all, I heard you say there are two must-dos, and that's 702 reauthorization and the IAA, right?
Mm-hmm.
But both those processes are open to amendments and also open to circumstances like San Bernardino or a Sony hack or more revelations about potential Russian interference. How on the Hill do you prepare, if you can, for one of those possible game-changing scenarios?
I think one thing we do, which I think is really good, is we started, for example, the 702 education process last year to try to make sure that in the calm of the day, people at least know, and these are members as well as the broader public, what exactly is Section 702, what is it authorized, what are the safeguards, what are the trade-offs involved, so that if something does go wrong, it's not suddenly, oh my God, what is 702, oh, let's just get rid of it and start over. So I think the education piece is really important, but that said, you know, when you start going into encryption or other type of issues, you could get an attack that does change the political dynamic, which could affect 702, which could affect provisions in the Intelligence Authorization Act, because those are subject to amendments as well. So one thing we're trying to do is education, but at the end of the day, you know, political dynamics can and often do change.
Absolutely. I mean, we are at the will a little bit of current events, right? So even though we can sit up here all day long and talk about how we have to pass the Intelligence Authorization Act and 702, which 702 has to get done, IA has to get done. But if something horrible were to happen tomorrow, that means a third priority, right? So we have to adjust our schedule. And like Michael was saying, with 702, we had the foresight to say, okay, let's get this ball rolling. Let's try to keep ahead of the curve, right? I do think that it is worth mentioning, however, that at any point in time, the executive branch could come down and say, we want this as a priority, right? So it's also for us trying to understand, and again, like the last panel was trying to figure out, what is the executive branch doing? What are their priorities over the next few years? So are we, right? We have to get kind of guiding posts from them as well. So, you know, who knows what might happen tomorrow where the executive branch come out and say, hey, we want you guys to pursue X or we want to do Y. So that very much applies to us as well.
Yeah, Hope Goins, did I hear you make some news saying the EO is coming out in the next couple of days?
Oh, no, no. I said we are waiting for it.
Okay.
I said we are waiting for it, and we've been waiting for it for weeks. And we know what we would like to see out of the EO, but hopefully we'll get it soon. But we've been waiting for it. I'm sure plenty of people in the room have seen drafts in the press, but we're actually waiting for the EO to come from the executive branch.
And Brett DeWitt, you mentioned the succession of drafts so far of that EO from the White House and how it appears to have incorporated some changes based on feedback from the public and the Hill.
Yeah, I mean, I would say where, you know, we first got indications back in November, December of direction, especially on, you know, looking at civilian versus military role for cybersecurity, there was a lot of angst, at least from our committee, on, you know, ensuring the importance of the civilian cybersecurity mission. And so initially there was that concern. I would say when the first draft was leaked, we saw that. We had significant concerns then. The second draft that we saw leaked was an improvement to that. And I think it was good because these leaked drafts at least provide input to it, maybe not as an official process, but I do think it's, you know, weighing the equities here and the importance of mission and roles, and you know, I think that's been, I guess, a good step forward. We're still waiting for the final executive order like everybody else, so it's time to see, you know, what changes are made.
May I ask Brett Friedman and the whole panel, to what extent or how would you describe the cooperation, outreach, collaboration you have entertained with the new administration? Are you in touch with Tom Bossert, who's the Homeland Security Advisor? Are there other people who are reaching out to the Hill or vice versa? What's the relationship like now? What should it be?
I think it's in its very early stages. I think this is part of this is also just the stand-up of a new administration, irrespective of party affiliation. It's a huge undertaking to gin up. I think you also have playing out, you know, the unexpected nature of what transpired in popular perception and what that meant for an administration that may not have been necessarily putting the foundation in as to who was going to occupy certain positions. And you may have had another side of it on the other side that basically was ready to, you know, from the line person all the way up, names, you know, all the process essentially ready to go. So I think that's just simply mechanics. From my standpoint, I mean, I would anticipate, I mean, the Intel committees are unique in the, I think, in the bipartisan nature with which we work more.
Sure.
We're co-located with the other party. And so I get the sense more of a very active dialogue with officials in the White House, particularly with regards to those administration officials in the cabinet that are coming through for nomination, right? So Mike Pompeo, next week we're going to be having a nomination hearing for Dan Coats to be the Director of National Intelligence. Those pieces are really where the rubber's meeting the road right now in terms of our interactions with the administration. Quite frankly, I defer to others in regards to, I have not personally, and nor do I expect necessarily to have, as the minority counsel on the Democratic side, an extensive dialogue. But I don't know how to characterize that. I would defer to you guys as to what engagement.
Well, I would say, from our committee, when Brett DeWitt just mentioned that we had some input on the executive order. Well, some of the input that we had on the executive order, the leaked EOs, was in public when we had Secretary Kelly appear before us in testimony. At other times, we have been able to have our ranking member and our chairman have had sit-downs with Secretary Kelly to let him know the committee's expectations for cyber and cyber at DHS. So as of right now, the outreach from the administration has been pretty good. But like Brett from the Senate side stated, they're just setting up and they're just getting started. But it is up to us in Congress to still let the administration know our expectations, either if it's a one-on-one meeting from our bosses or through an oversight letter.
Allen thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So from the majority side, you know, Chairman Nunez has a relationship with officials in the White House, but one of the things we're looking for is having that staff-level interaction as well. So that's something that, again, it's a new administration. They're still standing up, getting the right people in place. And so I think you'll be seeing more of that as time goes on over the next few months. But absolutely, I do think that there has been at that top level that type of coordination and communication. And I would imagine that same thing will happen eventually when the staff level, once they get everything worked out. So.
And I would say the same thing. I mean, my boss, Chairman McCaul, has had conversations with White House folks, Secretary Kelly, numerous times talking about cybersecurity issues and the chairman's priorities. So there's definitely discussion, dialogue, and we're collaborating. I know on the our legislation to elevate the cyber mission to create the cybersecurity agency at Department of Homeland Security, you know, full intention of collaborating with the new administration to do that in sync and in coordination so we can approach it together. So we just need to wait for the new team to come into place, the new senior leadership there, but we're excited to work with them and to get that done.
With respect to the Russian interference in the elections, Jay Johnson, the outgoing DHS secretary, had designated the election system's critical infrastructure. Moving forward, Hope and others, what does that mean moving forward? And do you expect this administration, or do you have a sense yet of this administration and its priorities for designating other pieces of critical infrastructure with respect to cyber?
Well, in our hearing that we had with Secretary Kelly on February 7th, he embraced the idea of having elections designated, election systems designated as critical infrastructure. I think one thing that when that designation was made, it provides DHS can provide assistance to states that actually ask DHS for assistance. So it's not mandatory;
yeah.
It's voluntary. However, even though Secretary Kelly embraced elections as critical infrastructure, that very same day, the Committee on House Administration voted on party lines to actually abolish the Election Assistance Commission. That measure has not been brought to the House floor. However, given what happened in the 2016 election, it seems as if we would still need the Election Assistance Commission, and that designating elections as critical infrastructure is a step in the right direction. I do believe that. I mean, that it's a pretty partisan issue because states, and you have to be a little wary of it, because states really feel as if the federal government is encroaching on them. And my advice to DHS and in conversations with DHS is to ensure, and which Secretary Johnson tried to do before he left, and if Secretary Kelly continues to embrace this, this would be in our conversations that we have with the administration, is to let the states know that this is all voluntary. This is not mandatory interference in their election systems.
Just to add and double down on that, I mean, it's exactly right. These are voluntary programs. Even before the election, 48 out of 50 states voluntarily sought out the assistance provided. So that's a good thing. What we want to watch and be careful for is anything that's a slippery slope into a forcing mechanism or the federal government saying you ought to do this or shall do this. That is where we'll have issues. But if you look at across the other critical sectors, the 16 of them, they're voluntary programs. So what does the designation provide? It provides prioritization of security clearances. It creates governance bodies for organization during steady state through the sector coordinating councils and the sector SSA sector specific coordinate councils and ISAC model under the National Infrastructure Protection Plan. That could also be leveraged in a way of like just regular steady state collaboration across the states. So there's a lot of good things, but you know, we definitely don't want to see any meddling by the federal government at the states. That's in the election process is to the states, and we wouldn't want to change that. So we'll just carefully watch.
I hear a big red line. Yeah.
You know, I think that's I definitely agree with that. My only concern would be the more government interference you have within the state election systems, right, the more opportunities there are for foreign actors to get in and meddle with state election systems. So I think that such approach is definitely reasonable. Mm-hmm. I would just urge caution and make sure we do so in a thoughtful manner if we go and move down that road.
Let's move on to, I remember getting emails, phone calls, a ton of outrage from former federal government employees who were victims of the OMB hack and some of the other recent hacks. which really, they got attention, but they didn't get as much attention as they deserved. How would you describe the security of some of these networks now? What is Congress's prerogative in ensuring better protections moving forward?
I think one thing that I could say on that is the cyber bill that we passed in, at the end of 2015 required audits. It required that all departments and agencies poll their organizations and say, okay, for example, of your IT professionals, how many of them have the minimum certifications to be IT professionals? Those results have started to pour in. They're not good, right? I've not seen one above 50% yet, right? So there's a lot of improvement there, and there's a lot that we can do on the Hill to really start pressing, say, no, we need to get, you know, not only our actual IT infrastructure, but the people who are working those infrastructures up to speed. Same on our supply chains and our procurement cycles. And we have to make sure that cybersecurity is factored into things like DoD procurement. Right? If we're not asking those questions at the beginning of procurement phase, then once the contract's already signed and you start building, and then you suddenly say, oh my God, this is not cyber secure. Then you're trying to bolt on, which is not only not the most effective way to do cybersecurity, but it's also far more expensive. So excuse me. So these are the kind of things that we start to press on and start to really worry about. The good news on that is, you know, if you look and you look at organizations, private companies or the government, there are like glaring holes in the cybersecurity. Sometimes it's just, you know what, put a username and password on that. Of course, that's not going to solve the 100% solution, but it's better than what you have now. And I think there's a lot of that. I said, okay, you don't have to have the most platinum standard cybersecurity, but you can certainly do more than where you are. We're at 49 or 50%. Let's get us up to 60%, then 65, then 70. All that will help. It's not going to be, we don't have to, the perfect can't be the enemy of the good in cybersecurity. And that's one of the things that we can press on. We can do through our Intelligence Authorization Act. We don't have to do big legislation either. We can start encouraging these type of improvements. And I think building on something else another panel said, we need to start making sure that we are growing the next crop of cybersecurity professionals. Yeah. And we have, on the intelligence communities, the IC itself does a lot of grants to universities. So those grants should be also to encourage more programs in cybersecurity. A statistic that I think is really worth mentioning here is of the top 10 computer science programs in the country, top 10 of the entire computer science programs in the country, not a single one of them offers a single course in cybersecurity. So we're here. It doesn't take much to get to there. It might be a lot to get to there, but everything helps.
Brett, to what you were talking about, you've already passed legislation encouraging DHS in particular to beef up its cyber workforce. What is the problem here? What can Congress do to goose the system?
So a couple of things. There, the three laws that we passed, it was the Cybersecurity Workforce Assessment Act, which requires a 10-year plan and then a 5-year action plan on how to get there. The Expert Hiring Authority, which makes it easier to recruit, retain folks. A lot of it has been just implementation of these laws that's been stovepiped. This comes out of the DHS Chico office, the Chief Human Capital Office, where this is getting held up. I know speaking with the transition team a couple months ago when we were talking to them about the work that we had done as a committee, that was one of the things that we had said was, you know, a huge opportunity out of the gate is to break that down so you can at least start building the capability capacity. So I know it's definitely on the top priority list for the new administration, and we've communicated. It's been disappointing it's taken this long, but we need to put resources to getting that done and fully implemented.
Do you all have the sense that the best minds out there in the private sector are disinterested in going into the federal government for ideological or other reasons?
I wouldn't say that. I would say, actually, while I would like to see DHS attract more cyber talent, that the private sector is still having a few problems with attracting some of the best minds in this field, too. I would say that, you know, historically, the federal government, the benefits, the flexibility, the ability to grow are there, and that's what attracts some of the workers. I would say some of the rhetoric that's out there now that disparages the federal workers and disparages the employees of the intelligence community is not good for recruitment. And even though DHS has expedited hiring authority, just the widespread rhetoric of a hiring freeze could probably sway an applicant from applying, but just because they think that they may not get hired. But I would say that the tone and the rhetoric that is taken against the federal worker could possibly be a deterrent to entering this line of work. But I wouldn't say that the best minds are just being had by the private sector, because the private sector still has openings too.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I used to work at NSA, and I can tell you the people there are absolutely incredible. I mean, brilliant people. Absolutely brilliant. You walk into a meeting and it's like, wow, you are so smart. I have no idea what you're saying. So let's take it back a few steps and let's do a chalkboard with stick figures and let's work it out. So I absolutely disagree that the best minds are not going into the government. They absolutely are. And I have nothing but respect for the men and women in the intelligence community. It's amazing the bright minds that are there. I mean, truly bright minds. And I think also part of it is, you know, they get to do stuff in the intelligence community you don't get to do in private sector. So I think you do attract kind of the fun, that fun aspect, right? So,
yeah. And it's the mission, right? In many instances, it's the people driven to, forgetting about the partisanship, just the ideological, the fact of doing something for your country. Authorities, abilities, encouragement to do certain things. I think that there's not, it'd be a challenge, at least within the United States, to be able to find those outfits that would allow you to do some of those things. And I think that that outweighs, in some instances, the, you know, when you're speaking of the direct, the monetary, right, disproportionate compensation that you see. So I agree with Alan, and I came as well from Fort Meade, and it was always, you know, the weirdest dressed person, you know, with the Hawaiian shirt, and you would never want to engage in a technical discussion with that person, but you knew their IQ was through the roof. And it was just, it was astounding and quite encouraging and fulfilling as well.
Just to echo that, I would say exactly right. The national security mission is key, both for offense or defense, whatever, you know, side whatever you'll be on. But you just need to make it easier. Not everyone's going to want a 20, 30-year career path within the federal government. And so you need to make it easier for the federal government to circle people in from the private sector for 5 years, maybe go back into government, back to the private sector. That has to be easier. And people do want to serve their country. To handle the national security mission, you get to do some cool things. But I think that's where there's some barriers that need to be addressed.
And if I may, I think that actually comes directly into conflict as well with the current procedures for getting your classification, right?
Absolutely.
For security.
Yeah.
There's just been a direct lag. I mean, for instance, I went to a school called Fletcher for a master's program at Tufts, and the majority of the students with whom I was in class with were foreigners. Is that a problem? No, I went to that school because of that cross-pollination. But then you get your SF-86, and it's just a question of, well, who are your close and continuing contacts? And then I have friends who are like, well, all of those people are close and continuing contacts. They're friends of mine now. And that ought not be the baseline, right? Yes, no. Or instead of a three-month approval, it's going to take 3 years, and therefore you're not going to stay around and wait for that job. So that is exactly needs to be encouraged. And that, going back to the private sector and coming back, well, God forbid you go to Beijing, right, for that private sector position. That's going to create a problem for the classification piece. So it's just, we need to marry those two up, because otherwise you're going to have a continuing long-term problems with regards to recruiting the best.
Yeah. Several of you in your opening remarks, and thank you for them setting the table, mentioned the importance of private public partnerships. You've been trying to incentivize this for a long time now in legislation and hearings and questioning of cabinet officials. What more can you do in that regard, if anything?
I would say the big key is metrics. It's showing value of the information being shared. That's key. I think that's the DHS cyber mission has come a long way over the last several years.
In a very short time. It's impressive, but they have a ways to go too. And while they have the functions that are outlined in the law that we've passed, when it comes to scoring those and it's really the assessments of how effectively are you carrying out those functions is where we need to see improvement. And if you can show that and demonstrate that value, I think that's where you'll incentivize the private sector to engage more. The other last big key is trust. Trust is so important with the private sector. And, you know, there was several years ago a big concern of DHS being a potential regulator in the cybersecurity space. You know, my boss under Chairman McCaul said that is not the direction we want to go. We want a trusted partnership between the private sector and the Department of Homeland Security. You're not going to want to share information with your regulator or someone who can prosecute you, as my boss says. You need a trusted partner in that, and that needs to continue to build. And they've come a long way, but there's area of improvement there. I know in March, out of the gate for us, those are some of the first hearings that we're going to be having, focused on the importance of trusted public-private partnerships and engagement, and how do you work together? Because 85% of critical infrastructure is owned in the private sector, there has to be collaboration. And scoring, where do the priorities need to go? What should the new senior leadership focus on? That's kind of what we want to cover out in the next hearing.
Let me interject. One three-letter agency I haven't heard much about from this panel is the FBI. To what extent did the recent court battles in California and New York implicate that trust between business and government?
Yeah, that was about almost exactly a year ago. And it really laid bare a seam that we need to close. And it goes to your previous question. There is a lack of trust, and it becomes very poignant with the FBI, because they're the people sometimes you as a private company want to call in when you're cyber attacked, but they're also the people you don't necessarily want rifling through your stuff, because who knows what they're going to find. And I think building, to bring up on Brett's point, building up that trust that, no, like when your house is broken, you call the cops. You don't think about what else are the cops going to find. You call the cops. We need to get to that level of trust. And before he left, John Carlin, the Assistant Attorney General for the National Security Division, he was encouraging that. He was saying, no, you need to call in those folks. We will help you through this. But I think companies are going to have to get comfortable with that. You can picture the board meeting in your mind. Do we call in the FBI when the general counsel is saying, we should call in the FBI? Yeah, but who knows what they're going to find? And they're going to maybe take our servers. They're going to take our, and how are we going to get shut down? Do we want people in, you know, the windbreakers coming through? How does that look for business? Those are issues that we actually really need to work through.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I'm completely with what Michael just said. For the encryption debate, though, I don't know if trust would have changed much of that. Mm-hmm. I think there were certain red lines there that, you know, the FBI had one position, the government had one position, and Apple had another. So I don't know if trust in those sorts of situations would actually help that. I think, to me, it was that classic case of when people say the law is notorious for lagging behind technology. You know, there's only a certain extent to which FBI and the government's willing to go, and Apple's willing to go. And if they can't meet, I don't know if trust is going to bring them together. So I don't know, maybe. But well, I do agree that increased trust is important.
I mean, the other flip side of that, though, is what you notice from actually reading the pleadings, too, it was very hortatory. It was people not necessarily making legal arguments right away, but engaging each other with rhetorical barbs, when really what is needed to happen is they need to get into a room, sit down and work through these things, not just with lawyers and not just with engineers in separate rooms and not with policymakers in another room, but really, as we found, because we've had those conversations, bring everybody together. You'll be amazed, even within companies, having the engineer and the lawyer go, oh, that's what you meant? Oh, I thought reasonable meant something else. Really, it's different languages, and when you get them together, it makes a big difference.
Yeah.
That's what I would encourage a lot more of, rather than trying to, you know, lob grenades at each other.
Behind the scenes, the messaging war was quite hostile. With private sector and public sector entities holding competing press conferences at the same time, featuring American flags and busts of Robert F. Kennedy and the whole thing. So it's hard to imagine some of that heat gets dialed down to zero in the oven in just a few months' space.
Well, I mean, but that's also something we talked about in 702. Now we're not in crisis phase, mm-hmm. thankfully. So, for example, we've commissioned a study by the National Academies of Sciences. Say, okay, just as you did 10, 20 years ago now, what's your latest thinking on encryption? Is it the exact same thing as the clipper chip wars, or is that too simplistic? Are there areas? And one thing we have to sort of keep in mind with going dark, it's not just about trying to, you know, if you picture a pie chart with a wedge out that's dark, it shouldn't be about closing it completely. You'll never close it completely. The same way, you know, think 30 years ago when it was just telephone, right? What people would do is they would not talk on the telephone if they wanted to go commit a crime. They'd go meet in a back alley or at a restaurant. Is that going dark? Sure. But they did not use the latest technology. They used something else to evade technology. We're always going to get into that. The question is, are there things that we can do to shrink that space? Same thing in cybersecurity. You don't have to get all the way up here. But the more you're up here, the better. I think those are the conversations that we need to have. Are there technical solutions, policy solutions, incentive solutions? What can we do to help shrink that gap?
Yeah, and I think that highlights, you know, sometimes people want to get on Congress for not doing anything, but actually there's a lot of oversight, and Michael said earlier that doesn't result in major legislation, but it is bringing those people in the room and trying to figure out, okay, from an oversight perspective, how are things working? Where can we help kind of steer the debate and steer the conversation and bring people together? So yeah, absolutely.
And if you look at the San Bernardino instance, which generated for the Senate committee an impetus or a direction from both the chair and the vice chair at the time, was we need to have put together a proposal whereby there would be lawful ability to get at communications if necessary, if you have lawful process. Now, if you recall, that bill never was formally introduced, but you better believe that that brought a significant amount of discussion on both sides. And speaking of bringing people to the table, that was really the underlying rationale. We need to have a dialogue here. One way of doing it is perhaps having a commission to look at the issue. The National Academy of Sciences, as well as other bodies, are continuing and coming out with reports. I think that in the end, getting the people together to talk, so you're not in the time-sensitive or crisis situation of San Bernardino. And, you know, I hope that Congress actually will proceed to something prior to the next instance. I'm not sure if that will be the case or not.
And really, to that point, I mean, that's a piece of legislation that my boss definitely wants to bring back up this year, working with Senator Warner. The commission to, you know, the next attack, you know, if, you know, God forbid it happens, make sure, you know, that we are moving the ball forward and that we're not going to have a knee-jerk reactionary response when the next big attack takes place. We want thoughtful, deliberative policy decisions informing where we go. This is a very controversial issue with many different stakeholders and equities in play. My boss frames it as a security versus security argument. It's not privacy, security, security for security, national security, and security of commerce, your personal information, and all your sensitive data. And so we got to think about it through. They're both important values. They shouldn't be at the expense of the other. But how do you do this in a thoughtful, deliberative way versus a reactionary approach? And we really thought that the commission enables bringing all the stakeholders together to provide Congress with very thoughtful solutions. So then Congress can ultimately have a menu of options that it can decide, because ultimately the Congress is going to have to decide path forward here. And but we need to inform Congress, and thoughtful, deliberative recommendations is the way, in our opinion, is the path forward.
One last question for you before we put it out to the audience. Several of you, Alan in particular, expressed some concern about cyber hygiene and sort of, as you say, and this notion that people, just average people in their houses, don't entirely realize what around them may be listening. The court case this year involving the Alexa device in someone's home and its possible use in a criminal prosecution. Do you think folks understand how technology is invading their lives in some intrusive ways? And what is the role of Congress in educating and helping them with that process?
So I definitely think, you know, panels such as this, and, you know, we're all just one person individually, so we can't do everything. But I think definitely education is key. I mean, when you look at the number of major cyber incidents over the past several years, it's astounding. You know, and don't get me wrong, the federal government and private sector repel however thousands, millions of attacks a day. But, you know, 2013, you have Target. 2014 was Sony and 2015, you had OPM. 2016, you have, you know, the election. So, and that's just to name a few.
That's
staggering when you put it in like that in a timeline. And I think that the government is doing its best to try to put in place, you know, the standards necessary to protect government as well as the private sector, to increase education. I know one notable thing from last year was the Small Business Association and NIST were trying to do more outreach to small businesses about cybersecurity. And, you know, this isn't just a big business problem, right? Cyber affects us all. For me personally, you know, I have friends who are teachers. I grew up in a family of teachers. And when I hear about, well, they're cutting cursive out of school, well, in my mind, that, first of all, drives me crazy to love cursive. But what are you putting in its place? And my mind is, kids today, especially now with the Internet of Things, have so much access to technology that what are we teaching young people about how to behave online, how to protect yourself online? And to me, that is absolutely crucial. So, you know, how do you do that from a legislative perspective? I'm not sure. I think we have to make strides and have those open dialogue, I think, and bring people together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that especially being reactive is not the best way to do things. So from a proactive perspective, it's how do we reach, you know, again, primary education? How do you teach people about how to act and what to do in cyber to protect yourself? For businesses, you know, should you be holding, you know, war rooms every once in a while? Do a cyber exercise, right? Part of the problem is how do you react to cyber? You know, you shouldn't have the CEO just saying, oh, there's a cyber incident, let me get my IT guy. So again, I think if you increase that cyber education on the front end, it's going to eventually spread out throughout business and the federal government.
Michael, you were talking about pre-Enron, post-Enron.
Yeah, no, I think it's the same thing. That's why at least, you know, a number of us are up on the panel doing this, because it is so important to increase the awareness of the cyber problem and take those steps to promote cyber hygiene. You know, maybe board should have, like, you know, I'm former Navy, every day we have the we'd have the ops and intel brief, the operations and intelligence brief. Should the CEOs get that every morning, like the president's PDB brief? What are the threats in my network? Just so that he or she sees that and everybody else knows that this is a priority that we need to care about. Are those the kind of things that we should be seeing? And I think Brett made a really good point earlier, though, is this being driven home at the individual consumer level? And I think as the IoT, the Internet of Things, increases, that's going to happen. And it goes to my first point, a lot of that's going to be playing out in the courts. Everyone's familiar with that famous case of that really hot McDonald's cup of coffee that burns someone, and they, right? But that big DDoS attack of, I think it was August or September, that went through coffee makers, mm-hmm. right? The botnet went through the coffee makers. They are IoT, Internet of Things. Now, let's say one of those, you're walking by one of those coffee makers and you get scalded by the hot cup of coffee, boom, you've got the exact same thing where people really care. The product's liability aspect of cybersecurity is going to drive a lot of this, yeah. unfortunately. Yeah. Right? A chip in your pacemaker is going to go awry. Your coffee pot's going to spew hot coffee on you. Your car is going to drive off the road because somebody hacked into it or introduced something into the supply chain that made it go faulty. And then the courts are going to step in and say, what was the level of precautions that company took? And the company will then know in advance, hey, I need to take a certain level of precaution. I think that's what's going to drive it.
We're going to have to end it here. Thank you so much to the panel. Please give me a round of applause. Thank you for your excellent.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the Hoover Institution and Intel Security for hosting event, and to Hoover for providing audio. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Please spread the word and promote the podcast via your social networks. And thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.